Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. A last-ditch effort to save the salmon. In Idaho, human activity is threatening the sockeye with extinction. Now, human activity is trying to save the fish. We'll have the story. Also this time, bringing the great outdoors indoors, year-round, starting your winter garden in summer. And garbage by any other name would not be garbage. Commentary from Joel McCower. And the U.S. auto industry sees the end of the automobile.
We see the concept of vehicle recyclability and improved vehicle recyclability as something in the future in North America.
These stories on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. On the shores of a mountain lake in central Idaho recently, a group of environmentalists, scientists, and political leaders held what they called a ceremonial experiment. By returning a few sockeye salmon to their natural spawning grounds in the lake, Idahoans hoped to curb the almost inevitable extinction of the fish. From Redfish Lake, Jill Hoyt reports.
Children's teeth chatter and their lips turn blue as they dive in, then quickly scramble out of icy Redfish Lake. The frigid waters may be cold for people, but salmon used to thrive here. Scientists say that historically 20,000 sockeye returned here each year. They migrated almost 900 miles up the Columbia and Snake Rivers, their color changing to red as they committed their final act of spawning before dying. Tribes depended on the sockeye for food, and for centuries would spear them as they stood on rocks along the lakeshore. Idaho conservationist Ernie Day remembers when the mouth of Redfish Lake was red with salmon.
30 years ago, I used to bring my kids over and watch the sockeye, the redfish, spawn within 100 yards of here. And since then, it's down to the last two sockeyes here, I guess, and I hope they can bring them back, but I'm afraid the deck is pretty badly stacked against happening.
That's because four dams were built along the Snake River in the 1960s and 70s. There are four other dams on the Columbia River. This gauntlet of eight dams slows the water current. As a result, says Idaho Fish and Game Department biologist Keith Johnson, more than three-quarters of the fish die on their migration to the Pacific.
If we're going to get anywhere, it's going to be by making strides in improving the migration conditions and decreasing the mortality rate.
Johnson and many other Idahoans want to improve the odds for the sockeye. The biologist leans against a white fish tank loaded on a pickup and smiles as he watches children and their parents take turns climbing up the steps and peering inside at a sight few have seen in the past decade. Eight sockeye salmon, each almost 2 feet long and weighing about 4 pounds. They are progeny of the only four sockeye that returned here in 1991. The sockeye were captured and bred.
Are they beautiful? Huh? Are they just gorgeous? Oh, I want to see. Oh my gosh, they are big.
On the white sandy beach near the fish tank, a crowd gathers around a podium and microphone. Charles Ray of Idaho Rivers United explains that these fish will be returned to their ancestral spawning grounds, and in 2 years, their offspring will migrate to the sea.
The release of these fish today serves notice to the Bonneville Power Administration, the Corps of Engineers, and the National Marine Fisheries Service that they have 2 more years before the offspring of these fish leave Redfish Lake. They have 2 more years to significantly improve these fish's chances of survival.
Wearing black hip boots, Idaho Governor Cecil Andrus and other dignitaries carefully take a bucket, scoop up the fish, and one by one free the sockeye into the lake.
You see it, Justin? There she goes, right there.
After releasing the salmon, Governor Andrus pulls off the hip boots while explaining that he wants the federal government to pour more water over the dams 4 months a year, so fish won't die during migration. But in the second week of August, the Army Corps of Engineers decided to delay doing a test of such a reservoir drawdown. And earlier this year, the National Marine Fisheries Service ruled the dams pose no threat to the salmon. Andrus wants to prove them wrong in court.
I don't like to go to the courthouse, but when I can't get anybody else to listen to me, that's the only place that we have left to go. It's a court of last resort in this situation. And I would lots rather have a federal judge trying to solve the problem than the Army Corps of Engineers or BPA or NIMS screwing it up.
But Merritt Tuttle of the National Marine Fisheries Service says his organization isn't screwing up.
Dams were found this year not to produce jeopardy, and that what jeopardy really means is are the dams at this point sending the salmon to extinction? And with the improvements that were made this year in the Columbia River system, particularly target flows, National Marine Fisheries Service found that those improvements were sufficient to avoid having a jeopardy decision.
But with only 10 sockeye salmon returning in the past 5 years to Redfish Lake, it's hard for many Idahoans to believe that the dams pose no jeopardy to the fish. As the sockeye ceremony ends at Redfish Lake, a storm blows in. The big black clouds, spewing forth thunder and lightning, are like trumpets announcing the next act in a drama that many Idahoans fear will not have a happy ending. At Redfish Lake, Idaho, I'm Jill Hoyt.
Jill Hoyt reports for the Regional Environmental Issues Unit of the Northwest Public Affairs Network. Don't you just wish summer would last forever sometimes? Doesn't it seem that winter is always just around the corner? For many gardeners, the growing season does not seem to last nearly long enough to enjoy, sometimes hardly even long enough to grow the flowers and vegetables. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, is one of those who hates to see the summer end. In fact, he told us recently about his way of saving a bit of summer all year long. The trick, he says, is to save it slowly and well ahead of time. Whatever that means, let's find out.
Hey, Larry, how are you doing?
Bruce, what's going on?
Oh, not much. There you are on your knees in your garden again. What are you doing?
Well, I'm digging up this chive plant because it's even though it's still nice and warm out, it's time to start bringing plants indoors for the winter. I know just because the season comes to a close doesn't mean you can't prolong the season by bringing some plants indoors. And that's what I'm working on right now. I'm digging up a nice big clump of chives, which I know that's in something that people can use indoors once the season's over. So if you want to bring things indoors, first dig up a nice big pot of it. You know, dig all the way around it, dig up a big bunch of the roots, and then put them in a pot, nice pot, put a lot of nice dirt around it, and then pack that down, just like you're planting an indoor plant, just like you're planting something, only you're going to take it indoors. And don't just automatically take it indoors. Let it sit outside for a few days and get accustomed to being in the pot, and then bring it indoors. The last thing you want to do is bring something indoors either too quickly so it hasn't got transition, or too late. If you wait too late in the season, the soil will be cold and the plant won't be able to be transferred inside.
So the point you're making then is not to wait until the snow is flying to say, oh my gosh, I got to go out and dig up my geraniums or my chives. Do it now while the soil is still warm and as though the growing season is still underway.
Right, and once you've dug up your this chives or whatever it is you're going to dig up, you can dig up all kinds of herbs. Herbs are actually one of the best things. Thyme, chives, even some geraniums. You see, I've got my geranium plant that I'm going to be bringing in. This has been sitting outside on my porch all summer long, and actually this plant is about 4 or 5 years old. I do this every year. I bring it inside, I prune it back, I start new ones, and then next spring I take them back outside and put them back outside.
What else have you got here?
Well, in addition to digging things up right out of the soil, there's other ways that you can prolong the harvest prolong your garden. Let me get my stuff here. And we're going to go over to my window boxes, and I've got some beautiful impatiens growing out of my window boxes. And rather than dig up the whole plant and bring that indoors, I'm just going to take some little cuttings off of these impatiens. Let me just set this down. And you can see they're in full bloom now. And what you do is just kind of dig, don't dig, but go pretty far down towards the root of the plant, the base of the plant. pull and then snip off a nice big long cutting. I'd say this is about 6 or so inches long. Pull off some of the bottom leaves and just drop it into a container of water. And in about 2 or 3 weeks, you'll get little tiny root hairs growing out of these impatient cuttings. And then once the root hairs come out, then you can plant those in some nice clean potting soil and nice pots. And you can do what we do every year is we have a nice big bank of impatiens growing on our kitchen windowsill. We look out over these beautiful impatiens, look out in our backyard, it's all snowy. Then, of course, in the spring, when it's time to repot our window boxes, we take the impatiens from the inside and put them back outside.
So again, just to recap here, the main point you're making is that in order to transition your garden from one season to the next, it's important to start early before the actual season itself dictates that you really have to get a jump on it.
Right. We made the mistake last year. We didn't take our impatient cuttings in early enough, and the impatiens got damaged by an early frost, and they just never did do well. We didn't have the beautiful display inside last year that we're used to, so this year I'm not taking any chances. I'm getting out here early. It's even before, right around Labor Day. I'm getting out here early and bringing the impatiens in now.
Okay, Larry, snip away, and we'll look forward to seeing your winter garden.
That's right. I want you to come down this winter, and I'll show you these beautiful flowers.
Proof positive it works. See you next time.
Take care.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His year-round garden flourishes in his home in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. What's in a name? Apparently, the difference between wasting natural resources and conserving them. Author and publisher Joel McCower recently received an interesting letter from Richard Cashmanian, a senior economist at the Environmental Protection Agency. Cashmanian observed that McCower, in a recent publication, had used the words trash or garbage to describe what is really compostable material. Are leaves and grass clippings trash? Does this mean the forest floor is littered with trash? Wrote Cashmanian. The question got McCower to thinking and to writing the following commentary.
Cashmanian's point is well taken. Cut grass is no more filth or junk than is a fallen tree. Those clippings contain stored energy and nutrients that can be of use. In a compost, for example, to create humus. Orange peels, eggshells, coffee grinds, and other organic items similarly contain resources that can be of value in a garden. And although Cashmanian's argument is largely semantic, his crusade is a worthy one. Until we can effectively break the old habits of thinking of these scraps and clippings as something of little use or worth, it will be much harder to change the things we do with them, diverting them from landfills and turning them into the valuable resources they really are. Cashmanian believes that a lot of the solution comes down to plain old American marketing know-how. In other words, we need to invent some new words and terms to describe these things. We've done this before, he points out. Ties are made from silk, not silkworm waste, he says. We buy honey, not bee spit. And peat moss is certainly not sold as waterlogged dead vegetative remains. He goes on to show how others in commerce have managed to reposition their products with a relatively simple overhaul of the language used to describe them. For example, the Chinese gooseberry gained considerable popularity after its name was changed to the kiwi fruit. As Americans became diet conscious, Kellogg's dropped the word sugar from sugar frosted flakes. In fact, the federal government itself has given new names to unappealing sounding fish species in the hopes that they'd become more palatable to consumers. So, what should we call all this stuff? Well, even Cashmanian admits there's no perfect answer. That's attested to by some of his suggested alternative words. Byproducts, clippings, cuttings, leftovers, materials, peels, prunings, residuals, residues, scraps, and trimmings. While some of these may be suitable for certain products, none of them seem satisfying enough to describe what comes out of my family's kitchen. coffee grounds, unsalvageable leftovers, empty cereal boxes, plant trimmings, the inedible parts of asparagus, and the occasional eggshell. Perhaps there's some suitable name for all this mishmash of daily life. Your suggestions are welcome. In the meantime, I vow to take a closer look at the words I use to describe the things we used to throw away but don't anymore. If we're going to change our ways, we'll have to change our mindset, and that begins with our vocabulary. Hard though it may be to change old habits, our failure to do so could jeopardize our ability to get our families, our friends, and our neighbors thinking and acting green. And that would truly be a waste.
Speaking to us from Washington, D.C., Joel McCower, writer and publisher of The Green Business Letter and The Green Consumer Letter, as well as co-author of the popular book The Green Consumer. His comments are heard from time to time on The Environment Show. Automobile junkyards across the nation will be a thing of the past. U.S. CAR, the United States Council for Automotive Research, has announced the coming of the recyclable car. U.S. CAR, a consortium of the big three automakers in Detroit, will be setting up a research and development facility in Highland Park, Michigan. Susan Yester, executive director of the Chrysler Corporation's recycling program, made the announcement at a press conference in Detroit.
The purpose of the center is going to be researching vehicle recyclability, the technology that's going to be necessary or the design guidelines that are going to have to be put in place by the automakers to improve the recyclability of the vehicles. Not only technology that we ourselves can promote, but technology that can be turned over to the dismantling infrastructure or the recycling infrastructure so they can go forward with a market-driven approach to improving the recyclability of our vehicles.
Just a bit more specifically, what kinds of things, activities, and research will be going on at this facility?
We're looking at what it takes to take apart a car, primarily the plastics area, glass, textiles, oils, fluids, and what we can do from a design perspective to improve taking those parts off the car and then potentially separating those parts into the different materials so the materials can be recycled to different uses. Let me give you an example. The seats in the car have a lot of soft foam material, urethane foam material. If we can figure out with the dismantling industry a way of cost-effectively getting to that foam, we have an excellent market in carpet underlayment that the foam from seats from cars can be sent to and recycled and reused. That's the idea.
And
not put it into the ground in landfill or divert as much as we can from the landfill, but find other uses both in the automotive area as well as other markets.
Yester says the recyclability will be a concept incorporated into the building of the car even before it reaches the assembly line as a new car.
We have to be thinking about the recyclability of the vehicle right at the concept of the vehicle. Because as our design engineers, as our stylists start putting lines on paper, they're also forming in their own minds the materials that are going to be used for the particular components and how those materials are going to be put together to make the component. And that's the key in improving the recyclability of a vehicle. How do you put the materials together, and what materials do you put together?
Yester says right now, 94% of the vehicles on the road in the United States are being recycled. That's 8 to 10 million vehicles. By recycled, she means parts for scraps, used parts. This new facility will develop technology to really do recycling.
Once the vehicle is finished at the dismantler and he's sold those parts that he thinks are profitable for him, then the vehicle goes to a shredder where it's cut into 2 to 4 inch pieces. The shredder then, with the use of magnets and other types of separation criteria, basically takes away the metals in the vehicle. the iron, the aluminum, the copper, and things like that, and sells them to the appropriate markets. What's left is called fluff, or automotive shredder residue, and those words are used interchangeably. That fluff is currently being landfilled, and it's approximately 25% of the weight of the vehicle. We, in the Vehicle Recycling Partnership, as well as with our partners, the American Plastics Council and the Automotive Recyclers Association, are trying to hone in on that 25% and see what type of technology is available to make that into a useful product for some other type of application.
Yester says in the United States, the average car is on the road for 13 years, after which time the car is scrapped for parts. Once it leaves the last owner, the car is taken apart for its viable components. Under the new process, there will be more viable components to the car. We as driver-owner-consumers will not have much to do differently. The scrap collector is the one who will benefit from being able to salvage more of the car. Not only will parts be reused, more of the materials in those parts will be recycled.
The reason that I'm making this distinction is because a dismantler sells parts and materials. So yes, if you need to have a new seat for a particular car that you have, you can go to the dismantler and buy that seat. But if he doesn't sell that seat to you, right now the seat is shredded and goes to a landfill. What we want to do is open up the opportunity for him to sell it to a recycler that can send it into the carpet underlayment industry, for example, so that the materials are diverted from landfill.
Yester says it is unclear at this time whether these new procedures and manufacturing techniques will result in cars that look very different from those on the road today. However, she says it is likely we will see the same individual differences between company brands as we do today. A Ford does not look like a Chevy, which is different and distinct from a Dodge.
The collaboration that we have under U.S. Car is that we look at pre-competitive research. Therefore, we're looking at the fundamental theories and the fundamental guidelines that need to be put into place to facilitate improved recyclability in the vehicles. Once you start looking at a particular design, a real-life car of the future, that becomes competitive research, and that is outside of the sphere of what the VRDC is trying to do. By law, we're constrained to pre-competitive research as a consortia.
Yester says this is a process whose time, if not already come, will be coming sooner than later.
We see the concept of vehicle recyclability and improved vehicle recyclability as something in the future in North America. Therefore, we, Ford, Chrysler, GM, and our collaborators are trying to put our heads together right now ahead of any type of in-depth discussion, definitely ahead of any type of legislation, and determine for ourselves what type of technology is required and what type of design guidelines need to be developed to ready ourselves when this discussion needs to take place so that we are fully able to participate in it.
Susan Yester, Director of Recycling Programs at Chrysler Motors Corporation, speaking to us from Detroit. The research facility will be located in Highland Park, Michigan, will employ 10 and dismantle 500 vehicles a year in the pilot program. The parts will be sold at auction, with the proceeds going back to the research project. The center is expected to open in November. Eventually, we may load our cans, glass, metal, and paper into the car for a trip to the recycling center, and upon arrival, leave the car itself, too. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks much for joining us today. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's program, drop us a line. Address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 192. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.